Right now it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday evening. It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Let's start out with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team will be having a restoration this Saturday, November 7th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Younger Lagoon at the UCSC Natural Reserve. We had a great turnout at our first work party at this new venue. A gathering of a dozen plus folks worked on the coastal bluffs removing invasive non-native Carpobratus edulis, or ice plant. Why don't they just say ice plant? We rescued a beautiful stand of Europhyllum stichiofolii, or lizard tail, and some coyote brush intermixed with creeping wild rye. We will continue our work on ice plant removal while enjoying these splendid ocean views with great pelican, gull, and shorebird displays. How do you get there? Well, go north on Highway 1, turn left on Swift Street, turn right on Delaware, go to the end, and you'll be at the UCSC Marine Science Campus entrance. Follow the road all the way to the final buildings located on the Ocean Bluff. Parking is free, no passes required. Our meeting up will be at the giant blue whale skeleton next to the Seymour Marine Discovery Center at 10 a.m. What is the Habitat Restoration Team? Well, it's a volunteer group working to restore native habitats in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Our program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It's going to be shining. But if things get particularly unpleasant, like it might get too hot, they'll call it a day. I don't think so. Tools provided, bring gloves and water. If you want to contact the program leader, her name is Linda. Her number is 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. By email, it's redwoodrn, R-E-D-W-D-R-N, at packbell.net, or visit their website at www.cruisecnps.org. And public scoping meetings are going to be held to receive comments on suction dredge permitting program. What are suction dredges? Well, those are what's known as airlift dredges, and they're used to tear up streams looking for gold. The Department of Fish and Game is holding public scoping meetings for input on its suction dredge permitting program. Three meetings will provide an opportunity for the public, interested groups, and local, state, and federal agencies to comment on potential issues or concerns with the program. The outcome of the scoping meetings and the public comment period following the scoping meetings will help shape what is studied in the subsequent environmental impact report. A court order requires the Department of Fish and Game to conduct an environmental review of the program under the California Environmental Quality Act. The Department of Fish and Game is currently prohibited from issuing any suction dredge permits. Yay! Under a court order that was brought by the Center for Biological Diversity, as I remember. Friends of the River ran on that one, too. In addition, as of August 6th, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's signing of SB 670 places a moratorium on all California in-stream suction dredge mining or the use of any such equipment in any California river, stream, or lake, regardless of whether the operator has an existing permit issued by the Department of Fish and Game. The moratorium will remain in effect until Department of Fish and Game completes its environmental review and permitting program and makes any necessary updates to the existing regulations. These scoping meetings, these are for the suction dredge permitting program, are going to be held in Fresno, Sacramento, and Redding. None of those are very close to Santa Cruz, but that's the breaks, folks. Members of the public can provide comments in person at any of the following locations and times. Fresno on November 16th at 5 p.m., Sacramento on Tuesday, November 17th at 5 p.m., and at Redding on Wednesday, November 18th at 5 p.m. And you should probably go to their webpage at www.dfg.ca.gov/suction-dredge, and you'll get more information about those meetings. You can also submit written comments postmarked by December 3rd. Or by email, you can send them to dfgsuctiondredge@dfg.ca.gov, or by regular mail to Mark Stopher, S-T-O-P-H-E-R, California Department of Fish and Game, 601 Locust Street, Redding, California, 96001. For more information about these meetings, the Suction Dredge Program, or to view the initial study and supporting documents, please visit www.dfg.ca.gov/suctiondredge. The Earth Liberation Prisoners Support Network has learnt of two recent arrests. A German woman has been arrested in Holland. It is alleged she was on a mink farm at the time of her arrest. It's also alleged that 5,000 mink had been released from the mink farm and some damage had been caused to the farm. For legal reasons, the name can't be released, but she has been taken into custody. If you want to send support, send it support messages, Holland at dieterbeferieier.de. Kind of a weird email address, but let me repeat it one more time. Holland, H-O-L-L-A-N-D, at dieterbeferieier.de. And the Earth Liberation Prisoners Support Network has learned of the arrest in Mexico where a 16-year-old was accused of Earth Liberation Front activity. Here's a report of his arrest. If anyone knows the 16-year-old and has any contact details for him, please contact Earth Liberation Prisoners Support Network. On the 27th of October, a 16-year-old Mexican activist was arrested at night and accused of being part of the Earth Liberation Front. He was riding his bike with a backpack. When police patrols started to follow him, he decided to get rid of the backpack and ran away with his bike. Sadly, the cops managed to capture him. Afterwards, they took the backpack and found four incendiary devices, each one made with two petrol bottles, another petrol bottle, a pair of plastic gloves, a balaclava, a lighter, a spray can, and environmentalist logos. He was sent to the police station where the police took pictures of him and found out that he is a vegan. He was kept there, those darn vegans. He was kept there all night, and the next morning he refused to talk to the police or explain why he was carrying all that stuff in his backpack. According to the press, he is expected of carrying out at least six attacks, five of them with incendiary devices. According to the press, Diego A., the arrested activist, admitted to being an anarchist, part of the Earth Liberation Front, and responsible for the six attacks. But according to the Mexican animal rights magazine, Rabia y Acafin, this seems to be false. Don't know what's going on here. But anyway, on the 29th of October, he was sent to trial, but the judge didn't find enough evidence to convict him in a special prison for younger men under 18 years. So he was released. Now his parents are responsible for his future behavior, and we thank the Earth Liberation Prisoners Support Network for that somewhat obtuse update. And a miner has asked Peru to remove protesters from its site. In this story by Patricia Velez, editing by John Picanic, from Thomson Reuters. Ares, a mining company run by Hochschild Mining, asked the Peruvian government on Thursday to remove protesting community members from one of its exploration projects, the latest in a long string of conflicts. Townspeople living near the Azuca development, which is looking for silver, took control of the camp last month. The site is located in the southeast region of Cusco. They say they are upset about potential pollution and contamination of water supplies stemming from the project. Though the company says protesters just want the firm to leave so they can be free to mine informally, Ares roundly rejects the invasion is motivated by an environmental conflict, and for that reason it demands the intervention of the public ministry, the company said in a statement. Residents in poor Peruvian towns often argue with foreign firms and the government over mining and energy projects. Periodically, violence erupts. This week, three workers died in an attack on a Chinese mine. Zijin's controversial Rio Blanco copper project in northern Peru. In June, 36 people died near the town of Bagua in Peru's northern jungle as police broke up roadblocks set by indigenous groups opposed to oil and mining exploration on their ancestral lands. Hochschild is the third largest silver producer in Peru, which ranks number one in the world for silver output. And the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society demands action by Netherlands. In a press release today, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands stated support for an amendment to the Dutch law that would facilitate vessel deregistration. Dutch Sea Shepherd board member Lawrence de Groot responded, "We have a Dutch ship with a Dutch captain and Dutch crew members, and we demand that the Dutch government take action to protect our safety from the dangerous and illegal attacks by illegal Japanese whalers in the Southern Ocean." De Groot is a former Rotterdam police officer who now serves on board the Rotterdam registered marine conservation ship Steve Irwin. For Sea Shepherd, the Steve Irwin is scheduled to depart from Fremantle in Western Australia on December 7th to once again interfere and harass illegal Japanese whaling operations in the waters off the coast of Western Australia. The Japanese whalers are targeting endangered whales in an established international whale sanctuary in violation of the Global Moratorium on Commercial Whaling and in violation of the Antarctic Treaty. I am appalled that Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende has agreed to change Dutch law to deflag the one ship in the world that is actually doing something to oppose illegal whaling, said De Groot. "We have not injured anyone, and we have not been charged with any violations. The Japanese whalers have tried to kill us, yet the Prime Minister refuses to hear our side of the story. He is more interested in appeasing the criminal activities of the Japanese whalers than he is of protecting the safety of Dutch citizens. We demand, as Dutch citizens on a Dutch flagship, that our government warn the government of Japan to cease and desist their violent attacks on the crew of the Sea Shepherd ship, Steve Irwin." Prime Minister Balkenende responded to concerns expressed by the Prime Minister of Japan that, as to whaling, I explained the Dutch government is working on a change in the law that would make it possible to take adequate measures against Dutch ships that commit unlawful acts. "The truth is that the crew of the Steve Irwin has not committed any unlawful acts. The Dutch government has not cited the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society or the captain and crew of the Steve Irwin with any violations. The governments of Japan and Australia have not charged Sea Shepherd with any violations. This is all political, and it is not proper for the Prime Minister of the Netherlands to be threatening to pass legislation to remove the Dutch flag from a vessel that has not been charged with doing anything wrong," said Captain Paul Watson, Sea Shepherd founder and president. "The Prime Minister should be more concerned about protecting the safety of Dutch citizens than he seems to be about protecting the interests of Japanese whale poachers." The Sea Shepherd whale defense campaign this year is called Operation Waltzing Matilda and will be the sixth expedition to intervene against illegal Japanese whaling. During these encounters, the Japanese whalers have used acoustical weapons, concussion grenades, and even shot at Sea Shepherd crew members. One bullet struck Captain Paul Watson in the chest, but was stopped by his Kevlar vest. Good thing he was wearing one. "I think the Prime Minister should be more concerned about Japanese violence than about our nonviolent measures to stop illegal whaling," said De Groot. And we thank the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society for this press release. And you can find out more about the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society at www.seashepherd.org. The response, ability to resist, determining why and when to fight back. A little exposition by a friend of mine by the name of Jesse Wolf Hardin. "I am no proponent of confrontation and wolf violence. I'm a proponent of wholeness and balance, diversity and life, freedom and compassion, nature and truth. But in the process of holding such values, I have not only felt it necessary to physically repel attacks, but also to protest injustice and impede destruction, and to intervene in situations where I wasn't even sure I could make a difference. I have done such out of a realization that we now teach in Anima that we are responsible for not only what we do, but also in part for any results that arise from or personal or collective acts, failures to act. I've heard it said that confrontation or violence is only justifiable or practical in immediate defense of one's home and family and never against an idea. And that we become no different from the aggressors if we forcefully resist them. Such points would seem to lead to some rather essential questions, ones that nobody can answer for us. Let's start with the first point, using the most exaggerated example for the sake of clarity. If we knew there were a band of murderous men, once abused as children but now sworn to the idea that raping and killing young kids is not only acceptable but somehow righteous, who were going from neighborhood to neighborhood doing the most horrendous things to the girls there, would you stay home rather than confront the acts this idea fed? Second question, what if their path and direction would soon take them into your own neighborhood? Would you wait until they were at your very doorstep to intervene, or postpone any attempt at action until you had personally and in the moment failed to talk them out of torturing your daughter? At what point does inaction, whether in defense of children or of the community, the forests we depend on, the threatened plants and animals with no constituency, voice, or defense of their own? On the other hand, perhaps, like me, you could justify taking offensive action before the raiders got to your town or block, striking their camp at night before any more atrocities could be perpetrated? In that case, we have to ask if you would take such definitive action even if the raiders were heading to attack a town in a different direction, or if they were committing their depredations in another country against people we will never meet. And there is the matter of degrees as well as emotional and physical distance. Would you stand up to forcefully prevent a girl from being emotionally abused or only physically? To protect a boy as quickly as a girl, an adult as much as a child, a stranger as well as a family member, a pet we are promised to, or a wild creature we may never see with our own eyes? Then what confrontation over the pollution of a water source that the children may as well as ourselves depend on? Raising hell over depleting and poisoning of a soil we cannot exist without? You might stand up for a plant that you use for herbal medicine or food-bearing fruit tree your grandmother once tended. Or what about those wondrous species with no known human use, whose beautiful flowers you may never lay eyes on? And then there is the matter of fighting against acts, but not ideas. In general, it sounds good, since so much personal injustice has been committed as part of attacks on religious and cultural ideas, from the imprisonment of outspoken revolutionaries to the violence that drove the Puritans from England to America. We must ask ourselves, was the time to confront Nazism when they were gassing thousands of scapegoated Jews and gypsies, or when the idea of an all-powerful elite was first foisted on the German people? If we could justify confronting or forcibly obstructing the abuse of children or the ecosystem, to what degree might we also be willing to confront people or institutions teaching, promoting, or even imposing a dogma where abuse is held to be justifiable or even laudable? Can an idea, by virtue of the multiple evil acts or climate of oppression it engenders, be more harmful and in need of our active opposition than a single instance of a person being physically attacked? When using activism or even violence for some end, we may indeed be in some danger of emulating the destroyers, of becoming like them, but only if we are detached and lack a clear ethos as to both what is acceptable and what is intolerable, what we would risk death for, but also what we live for. Only with the above questions asked and more can we hope to have the kind of personal ethos and code that can make us as effective as well as responsible co-creators instead of victims in this world and life. And for those wishing assistance with the creation of a code of honor that reflects your values and beliefs, you might benefit from enrollment in the Anima Orientation Correspondence course. To check that out, go to www.animacenter.org. That's www.animacenter.org. And here's some biological diversity news. Protection has been sought for 83 U.S. corals, defending scores of the world's most imperiled coral species from global warming and ocean acidification, which threaten all corals with worldwide extinction. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed a scientific petition to protect 83 corals under the Endangered Species Act. The corals, which occur in U.S. waters from Florida to the Caribbean to Hawaii, are among the species most threatened by climate change. Corals are facing the double danger of warming ocean temperatures, which may cause mass bleaching events and die-offs, and ocean acidification, which robs them of their ability to build calcium-based skeletons. Scientists have warned that coral reefs will probably be the first worldwide ecosystems to collapse under global warming. All the world's reefs could be destroyed by 2050. That's just 40 years from now. Thanks to an earlier petition and litigation by the Center for Biological Diversity, two coral species, elkhorn and staghorn coral, became the first species to be protected under the Endangered Species Act due to global warming. And the EPA on mountaintop removal, one down, one to blow. Last Friday, the Environmental Protection Agency revoked a permit for the largest mountaintop removal mine in Appalachia, taking the first step toward vetoing it. The Spruce Mine would have buried more than 7 miles of streams and annihilated 2,300 acres of hardwood forest. This is the EPA's first ever revocation of an already issued permit. But don't celebrate just yet. The EPA said the Spruce Mine represented unusual circumstances and the agency doesn't expect to veto any other projects. And the very day before it revoked the Spruce permit, the EPA cut a deal with a coal company that will expand another of Appalachia's largest mountaintop removal mines. The EPA is under tremendous political pressure from politicians in the pocket of big coal who are already demanding that the Spruce Mine be allowed to move forward. The agency has caved to these same politicians before. In March, it retracted a statement that mountaintop removal permits would be put on hold just 1 day after the statement was made. And logging threatens goshawk and old growth, 26,000 acres. The Center for Biological Diversity sharply criticized the U.S. Forest Service's latest take on devastating plans to log old growth trees in the Kaibab National Forest. Unfortunately for the forest, which houses the largest breeding population of the imperiled northern goshawk in the country, the Forest Service has issued a new environmental assessment for the controversial Jacob Ryan timber sale, which would log 26,000 acres but was halted in May thanks to work by the Center and the Sierra Club. The new assessment drops protections for old-growth trees, essentially stating that the Kaibab Plateau has too much old growth. So axing those irksome old large trees would be good for wildlife. This marks the Forest Service's fourth attempt to move forward on Jacob Ryan, and the center will make sure that it's its last. A big win for the polar bear, 128 million acres are slated for habitat protection. Thanks to a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to safeguard more than 128 million acres of habitat for the polar bear, the largest area ever designated as federally protected critical habitat. The proposal is a great step toward protecting the great white bear. Designating critical habitat will prohibit federal agencies from any activities that could harm the animal on all 128 million acres. Species with federally protected habitat have been found to be more than twice as likely to be recovering than those without, and the bear needs the best odds it can get, especially because the habitat proposal comes in the same week that the Obama administration approved oil drilling plans in the bear's habitat in the Beaufort Sea. The administration has until June 30th of next year to finalize the habitat protection. And do freedom-loving Americans hate jaguars? As if it's bumbling, possibly criminal actions that culminated in the killing of the last known U.S. jaguar weren't controversial enough, the Arizona Game and Fish Department this week justified efforts to prevent federal protection of jaguars by saying that any freedom-loving American would oppose regulations to protect the America's largest and most endangered cat. In response to Center for Biological Cold Diversity complaints that 12 years of state leadership have accomplished nothing to protect jaguars and their habitat in the United States, the agency countered that its efforts actually focus too much on jaguars, go figure. With a membership and staff composed of freedom lovers who do not neglect jaguar liberty, the Center for Biological Diversity has sued the Arizona Game and Fish Department to stop it from capturing or killing any more jaguars. A previous center suit won a order overturning the Bush administration's refusal to establish these pesky recovery plans and habitat protections that Game and Fish find so objectionable. The Obama administration has appealed the ruling, but we're confident that freedom-loving judges are not about to consign the American jaguar to extinction. And shrew habitat protections are to expand 55-fold. Responding to a Center for Biological Diversity lawsuit battling corrupt endangered species science this Tuesday, probably a while ago, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed a greatly expanded area of protected habitat for the Buena Vista Lake ornate shrew. The highly endangered, highly intriguing shrew is now found in only 4 locations in Central California. Almost all of its former habitat has been damaged by agribusiness and development. Though the shrew's survival depends on substandard habitat protections, in 2005 the Bush administration ignored science showing the species needs and protected a paltry and fragmented 84 acres. The service's new proposal is a true improvement for the shrew, acknowledging that the species needs 55 times more acreage than has been protected since 2005, a total of 4,649 acres of habitat. The center's successful suit for the shrew is part of our larger effort to undo politically polluted endangered species decisions made under the Bush administration, covering 52 more species. So far, the Obama administration has agreed to trash most of those bad decisions. And $135, that's all it costs to lay claim to a mine on a 20-acre plot of public land. Drive 4 stakes into the ground and pay your fee, and you've got yourself a new mine right in the middle of a national forest. Find $1 million in gold, you get to keep it all. The taxpayers that own the land get nothing but the cleanup costs after you're gone. This is the scenario facing public lands in the West under the 1872 General Mining Act. In Oregon, nowhere is the threat of harmful mining at taxpayer expense more acute than in the Siskiyou Wild Rivers area. Home to some of the strongest salmon runs in the state and unmatched biological diversity, the Siskiyou Wild Rivers, or Oregon's Yellowstone, is under fire. It didn't have to be like this. Even with our antiquated national mining laws, President Clinton proposed in 2001 to protect Oregon's Yellowstone from mining by issuing a mining moratorium for the area. The Bush administration failed to follow through on the temporary safeguards, and a boom in mining claims filings ensued. Since 2001, over 800 new claims have been filed in southwest Oregon. Over 300 of those are now active mine operations, spilling sediment into sensitive streams, leaching chemicals into soils, and bulldozing by heavy equipment through the forest. In the 21st century, most Oregonians probably view mining as a distant threat of the past. However, just 20 years ago, the Formosa mine outside of Riddle, Oregon, was in operation. After 3 years of copper and zinc extraction, the Canadian company that owned the mine abandoned the 100-acre property. Today, it's a national Superfund site, spilling toxic chemicals into nearby waterways. And you don't even have to go back 20 years. Just last month, a miner allegedly took heavy equipment into a mining claim outside of Cave Junction and illegally chopped down trees and began digging ditches. That miner now faces a November court date. In addition, a California ban on suction dredge mining in salmon streams in Northern California has miners eyeing rivers in Southern Oregon as their next target. The lesson is clear. With laws written during the days of the Wild Wild West, you're bound to get, that's right, Wild West behavior. So despite the threats, there is a clear path towards a solution. It starts with a reinstatement of the 2001 mining moratorium that would provide sensitive areas within the Siskiyou Wild Rivers a temporary reprieve from damaging mining activity. At the urging of Oregon Wild and our allies, the Siskiyou Project, Klamath Siskiyou Wild, and others, Oregon Governor Ted Kongloski took action. The governor sent a letter to the heads of the Department of the Interior and the U.S. Forest Service requesting reinstatement of the mining moratorium. If you have a moment, call Governor Kolongoski's, I guess, office. I can't. And thank him for taking a stand against harmful mining. Here's the governor's phone message line, 503-378-4582, 503-378-4582, and we thank Oregon Wild for that press release. Visit their website, oregonwild.org. Let's wind up with the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. The lands along Yellowstone's border remain quiet with no sign of bison migration beginning yet. This is good news as Montana's so-called bison hunt is set to begin 10 days from now on November 15th. The Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer migration has begun, however, and day by day, more folks are arriving at Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters to prepare for another season of Buffalo Defense. Our thanks go out to everyone who has already sent in comments on the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service on their bovine brucellosis program concept paper. APHIS would like nothing more than to continue mismanaging wild buffalo and elk for the benefit of the cattle industry, but your voice will challenge them to do otherwise. Nearly 100 comments have been posted so far, with the overwhelming majority being for the wild. APHIS will accept comments through December 4th. You all can read about the proposal, review sample talking points, and read the Buffalo Field Campaign's official comments, and visit the Buffalo Field Campaign webpage for details on submitting your comments. A special thanks to all of the buffalo family who once again helped spread the word to save the herds. This fall's West Coast Roadshow was a huge success. First off, I would like to thank Good Shield, who for the last 6 years has dropped everything in his life to come on tour to help the buffalo. Phoenix After Buffalo also came and played all the shows he could this year and has confirmed again for next year. Our newest helper and mentor is visionary Derek Jensen, who also committed to another show next year, and a big thanks to Samson and Krista for their help year in and year out. Thanks for always being there. A big hearty thanks to the following people for making the roadshow a success: Nikaya, Laura, Sundog, Amber, Cove, Jasper, Tony, Susanna, Frank, EARC, Sheila, Linda, Tony, Monica, and Kingman. I'm sorry if I forgot your name, but I am truly thankful to all of you who helped us save the buffalo in any way. I'm planning a month-long show next year, going from Washington to California and back up to Montana through Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Idaho. Please feel free to contact the Buffalo Field Campaign if you would like to set one up in your community next year. And they usually run those in August and September, I believe. The Buffalo Field Campaign can be reached at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And they have some pages there about stuff they need, so check those out. One of the things they need is money. Send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana 59758. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana 59758. Or give them a call at 406-646-0070. Once again, that webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only organization working in defense of the last wild buffalo every day of the year, rain or snow or whatever happens in Montana and Wyoming. All right. Well, that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and at www.freakradio.org. If you'd like to hear a podcast or rebroadcast of this show, navigate to www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another Earth First Update, and we thank you for listening.